it's not just a one-off thing. It's not just a random footprint on a, and then nothing happens for 10 years. This is a build-up in one specific, very small patch of jungle where you're seeing repeated activity that has been analysed by credible scientists over a decade now.
Ladies and gentlemen, the
trying to solve the mystery of such a creature, such a remarkable creature that we'd learned so much about, is what prompted me to spend so much of my time looking into Mothra in the last few years. Man, it certainly ain't the food.
On that note, what kind of stuff did we... I keep saying we, I don't...
No, it's cool. Yeah, we've been talking for years, now you're part of the team, so come on in through the virtual door and join me.
There you go.
And as I canoed across the lake to our base camp, you can hear all the ooh, ooh, ooh hooting of the gibbons as you arrive, you know.
Oh, boy.
It's an amazing, amazing place.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 6, and I'm very excited about this edition of the program because it sort of serendipitously has developed into an annual tradition of its own. Our guest is, of course, extreme explorer, world-class cryptozoologist Adam Davies, and he's coming back here for his fourth appearance. Comes back every January. We like to call it his audio base camp, where he updates us on his trips of the past year and his expeditions of the past year and his journeys of the past year, because he's doing some amazing stuff. Every year he's off searching for these creatures that are, some of them are right very, very close to getting picked up, folks. And we're talking about the Orang Pendek. That was his big thing this year. He's kind of becoming synonymous with the Orang Pendek because of this research, because he's getting so close. This thing is just so close. It's so exciting. And, you know, I was excited when I first had you on the program 4 years ago, and I had a feeling, you know, this guy's doing what we need to be done to get to the bottom of these things. And you've continued to do it, and the results have been remarkably awesome every year. So I'm going to keep having you on the program. Hopefully someday, you know, some year we're going to have you on and it'll be like, well, this was the year you did it, bro. We, you know, crack open the champagne because, you know, we got the Orang Pendek. I say we like I had anything to do with it, but.
No, I'd certainly welcome your support, Tim, but we can talk about it. Yeah, sure.
But anyway, Adam Davies back on the program, and it's always just like a trip down to the pub when we get together talking here. That's why it's been loose already here. And, you know, welcome back to the program. Formalities, you know, Extreme Expeditions is the book. Check it out from Anomalous Books, and you can find out more about them on Facebook. Adam, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Tim. It's a real pleasure. I love doing the show, and I love talking to you. Be good. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, I always have fun. I always have fun when I talk to you.
Me too, man.
Now, when we last talked last year, you sort of, it always seems like it's fresh start around this time of year for you, and you're looking ahead to the year, and I don't recall if it was last year or the year before, but you were sort of like, you know, you're thinking you were going to, you know, take a breather from the Orang Pendek a little bit, look at some other stuff. I know you did the Mokele Mamembe, which got some good press recently from the BBC. But then you ended up here in 2011 going back after that damn dirty ape, the Orang Pendek.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I'd done India the year before as well, the Mandi Barung, which was a great trip, and it was the first time to go. But I did end up going back to Sumatra, and that was because I'd got a high concentration of sightings, again, in a particular area where I'd been before. My contacts in Sumatra have been saying, look, we've got some real activity here. We've got some really good leads, really good eyewitnesses, and, you know, it's credible. So it's worth going out there. So I kind of thought, do I want to go to Sumatra again? There's other things I want to do, and I'm definitely doing a couple of other things in the next year or so, which I'll tell you about later. But I thought, I've just got to go. And so it was time to get together a team, and luckily, because I had a lot of contacts, I was able to put together a really great international team. Basically, we had It was the CFZ expedition of that year, and obviously I was leading it. But because I had 10 people who wanted to come, I divided it into two groups. And basically, the methodology was, well, let's go to Gunung Tuju, which is the volcano where there's been a lot of sightings and where I've got hair and prints, but also let's go to the lowlands where myself and Andy Sanderson had previously heard the Orang Pendek calling out. So I divided it into two teams. I had a tracker on each team. I put Chris Clark in charge of the lowlands team, Dr. Chris Clark, along with a tracker in John McGowan, and CFZ Australia in Mike and Rebecca, and Lisa Malin was there as well. And then I took myself, Andy Sanderson, and a tracker, Dave Archer, and a Dutch guy had been before, who'd also got recent evidence, Tim Dufrell, and we're together with Richard Freeman up to the higher camp as well. So we had a two-pronged team. We had more camera traps than we'd ever had before. We had the best guides I could possibly get, and we were obviously out there to find as much evidence as we could. And we had a crew from the BBC with us too.
Oh, nice.
So we kind of divided it up and did it that way. And I went up there with my best guide, Sahar, and good friend as well. And the evidence we found was again very, very compelling, Tim.
Very nice, very nice. See, this sounds amazing. This is a really well thought out and well put together thing, and it's remarkable to look at the evolution of these expeditions as they go on. Because like the first year, where you just kind of like just trekking around in the jungle, looking around, getting a feel for what it was all about. And now here in 2011, you've got this expansive, two-pronged attack on the issue. So it's amazing. It's remarkable to see.
Yeah,
how far
I think that's exactly what it is. Because when I first went and I first trawled around, I sort of did scouts of the area, and then I concentrated on an area with specific sightings, and you sort of get closer and closer to pinpointing the evidence. And then, you know, from there, you learn exactly what routes it might go on. I was thinking about how it migrates. Was it solitary? What are its feeding habits? And what's the best time of the year to go? So you're constantly refining each time you go your research and your knowledge, so you're sort of pinpointing it. And I'm trying to, when I'm out there, actually think how it might behave, what it might be looking for, what's the best way to track, and what's the best way to get evidence for it. So, you know, if I start planning an expedition, any expedition I do takes a minimum of 6 months to sort of gather together so that it's good, because it's, you know, it's my own time and my own money and that of the people with us. Nobody funds us. So we have to do things on a shoestring. But if we're doing things on a shoestring, I'm going to damn well make sure that we have the best shoestring we've got we can possibly go for. So it really is really concentrated planning, and that's what pays off. You know, I'm all for people doing expeditions, but do the research first, man. It's so important.
Yeah, yeah. Just don't hop on a plane to Mongolia going after that death.
No, no. Please. Well, if that's your crack, go for a holiday, but you're not going to get anything out of it unless you do it first.
Now, is this your fourth time you've been to Sumatra,
it's
or
the
was
sixth
it
time?
Sixth
time?
Sixth time. Wow, sixth time.
Yeah.
So yeah, you hear the call, like you know, I can feel you. You know, you get the reports, and you're like, I got to go back, man. Because it's tantalizing.
Exactly,
this is so tantalizing. Every time I hear about you going back down there, it's like, oh, he's so close, this guy. Based on just how extensive this one was, does it seem like the perspective sort of changing? Is there an air of excitement around this thing? Because I'm feeling it, you know, an air of excitement around the Orang Pendek down in Sumatra, and also from where you are in the UK, you know, and how it's coming together up there and stuff, and you're putting it together. It's like, is there sort of this air of excitement around it? Because I'm feeling it.
Yeah, I think there's
momentum, even, might be the word, too.
Yeah, I think momentum's a good thing. I mean, what I did, momentum is exactly what I wanted to build when I wrote the Edge Science magazine article, the new primate species in Sumatra article. Because from that, I specifically put together evidence that had been analysed by credible scientists who were leaders in their field, who had all come to the same conclusion, unknown primate, yeah? Mm-hmm. So, for example, I talked about the prints that I'd found on previous expeditions that had been analysed by the primatologist Chivers, who'd said unknown primate. I talked about Jeff Meldrum, I got analysing them. I talked about the hairs that had been analysed by people like Hans Brunner and Lars Thomas as unknown primate. So, I said, well, look, it's not just a one-off thing. It's not just a random footprint on a, and then nothing happens for 10 years. This is a build-up in one specific, very small patch of jungle where you're seeing repeated activity that has been analysed by credible scientists over a decade now. So when that evidence is gathered, it becomes very difficult to refute, because what you're basically saying is, well, all these scientists who've analysed this stuff over a number of years, they must all be wrong for it, or they must all be inconsistent for it to not be the case. And what I've demonstrated, I feel, is this consistent scientific opinion that has pointed to the existence of an unknown primate in Sumatra, and that's what I've been seeking to do. Because eyewitnesses' accounts are great and they make an interesting tale, but in the world of science they count for nothing. What you want is independent scientific evidence that can be corroborated and analysed by peers. And that's what I've been seeking to build for the existence of the Orang Pendak.
Exactly, yeah. It was a tremendous article, and the evidence is stacking up more and more. And for some odd reason, like the radio guy part of me feels like I should ask you, just sort of give us the thumbnail on what the Orang Pendak is for people who are tuning in. This is the first time they've heard you on the show. They should go back and check out the previous three episodes. But, you know, let's give them a thumbnail so they're not just listening like, oh, he never even said what it was. I don't understand. So let's take care of those.
Yeah, totally. Well, basically, the stories about the Orang Pendak go back centuries, yeah, and that's what interested me in the first place, because it's not a case of some, like, plastic yeti that's sort of knocked about from the 1960s.
Right.
And it's not a yeti. It's called the short man of the jungle, Orang Pendak. And the first stories, which were translatable, go back to Marco Polo's time when they talked about, in Sumatra, these weird bipedal, short, hairy men. So in other words, walking on two legs, who lived in a particular part of Sumatra. And, you know, from the times when the Dutch, were active in the area, when they, colonized, or for want of a better word, governed, I think is probably a better word, Sumatra, to right up to the present day with eyewitnesses like Debbie Marta, there's a consistency of sightings of something that has the face of a human, or appears to have the face of a human, but the body of an ape. But the most interesting thing is that it walks like a man. So it's a bipedal primate, quite short, lives in the jungle, it's enormously strong, extremely shy. It isn't sophisticated in the sense that its tool use would be commensurate, say, with that of a chimpanzee, so it doesn't have fire. But it's an incredible story. I mean, it definitely exists. There's no fancy about it. So trying to solve the mystery of such a creature, such a remarkable creature that we'd learned so much about, from a scientific point of view, is what prompted me to spend so much of my time and money in Sumatra over the last few years. Man, it certainly ain't the food, do you know what I mean?
Absolutely, yeah. This is like the white whale. This is the one that...
Yeah, it's the white whale. It is definitely a Moby Dick thing for me. I would not be eating that. I mean, with the best one in the world, I love the people and everything else, but, man, I'm not a big fan of the food. And there are only so many curried fish heads one man can stomach.
Now, I was kind of dancing around this trying to get the right words, but how do they feel about this whole thing down in Sumatra? Are their perspectives changing on it as you keep coming down there? Like, do they recognize you now? Are you sort of like, you know, like the Brad Pitt of Sumatra when you come into town on the excited?
I wish it was the Brad Pitt. I might be able to pull an Angelina Jolie lookalike, but maybe that's stretching it. Maybe there's more chance of me finding the Orang Pendak doing a cabaret in Manchester than there is of me doing that. I think with the local people, I think when I first went, I've noticed a difference, and I think that's because of in some ways, westernization. When I first went, people were a bit like, well, what does he want to go into the jungle for? I'm not really sure about the place. To now, with the advent of technology, people are far more aware of it, you know, and Sahar's, when we were going to the mountain, for example, this time, Sahar's son Raffles was with us, and I can speak a very little bit of Indonesian, and he was on, you know, as we were going up the mountain towards the jungle, he was like talking to his girlfriend, saying, no, I love you, no, you put down the phone first, no, you, no, you, and then I said in Indonesian, come on, Raffles, get on with it, and he looked really embarrassed, you know. So So there's been like this, there's a technological awareness as well. And I think for the local people, what I've tried to impart on them is that it's important for their own self as well, that if they preserve that jungle, then they're preserving not only a unique environment where other endangered species live, not least the Sumatran tiger, but that, you know, it's their legacy, it's their heritage, so it's worth preserving. It's a remarkable place. And all the, you know, you don't want a palm oil plantation there. You want that jungle. It's just beautiful, Tim.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Well, this is also, you know, like we've talked about on the show before, this is like all about, this is a race against the development, I guess you could say, you know, a race to try and make sure we can prove this thing is real before these jungles get taken over, because they, you know, we got to preserve the animal because they seem extremely rare.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're talking about building a new road through there at the moment. So, it's all about, I mean, if you went to the place where I normally go a lot of the time, I'm not being dramatic when I say it looks like a scene out of Jurassic Park, you know. Mm-hmm. The first thing I saw when I got to the jungle this time was a giant cobra just as I entered the lip of the volcano. You can see, I saw a fish eagle swoop across the lake, and as I canoed across the lake to our base camp, you can hear all the hooting of the gibbons as you arrive, you know.
Oh boy.
Just outside the camp, there's a massive tiger print. It's an amazing, amazing place. And it's an international treasure. And whether you're skeptical or otherwise of the research as we talk and as I present it to you, nobody who has an ounce of soul within their body could deny that this is a place worth preserving. And the motives behind preserving the Orang Pendek are purely altruistic. There is nothing in it for me other than preserving the environment and the creature.
Exactly. You're not going to open a theme park there or anything, right?
No. And I don't make any money off it. I'm not interested in things like that. I'm not interested in materialism. It never appeals to me.
So let's dive back into the CFZ Sumatra Expedition 2011. I love the title of it. Now, you kind of talked about how you got these reports and everything. So was this sort of like your brainchild here to get it going, or were the guys from the CFZ sort of all the same mindset and you all came together? How did sort of, what was the germination?
I lead the expedition for them, yeah. So, you know, a lot of the people there are already friends of mine, so mm-hmm. we talk regularly. And that's kind of how it evolved. Obviously I contacted my guides in Sumatra, and together with Andy Sanderson and Chris, we did a lot of the initial planning for it, contacted Dali and Sahar to organize, you know, the basics, Tim,
yeah.
the food supplies, the transport. It's all about maximizing the time when you're there. You don't want any time hanging around. I want to just be there, get into the jungle, go, and then off you go somewhere else. So,
yeah.
So a lot of the logistics were there. And then when we all met up, because some of the people, you know, I didn't know that well, like the guys from Australia and Tim, I went through the plan and we discussed how that would formulate. So there was a lot of background work, but it was more about, once we'd done that, it was more about getting on with it. Simple as that. Off you go.
There you go. Yeah.
Maximize your time and get on with it.
As you know, I like to take the audience sort of into this trip as best I can. So you get in there to the jungle, then how long do you guys like split up into teams? And then how long were you guys separated? And was there communication between the two teams?
Yeah, those are good questions. Let me break it down by saying we travel down. We spent a night in a homestay where I went through the plans, mm-hmm. and then the two teams completely split up. It was always a worry in the sense that, because I'm responsible for other people's lives, it was the first time where I'd had two groups,
right.
and I wasn't in contact with the other group, so that played on my mind. But they were in the lowland area, so potentially there was less risk in the sense that if they did have an injury like an ankle break or something like that, they could get out, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
With the people who went on the top, they'd all been to Sumatra before. So there was less, you know, but again, it's an enormous risk. If someone hurts themselves up there, then, you know, it can be very, very serious. So I wasn't in contact with them at all. Like, we managed to get one phone signal out to them to organize a pickup for the BBC crew who came after we'd been there about 5 or 6 days, say, yeah.
Okay.
So we managed to get them in and them out. But pretty much I didn't speak to the other group until we came out of the jungle at the end of the expedition.
And how long was that?
No, I think it was a couple of weeks.
Okay.
So roughly speaking, it was a couple of weeks. So probably I didn't speak to them for about 13 days or so, roughly.
Yikes. So they could have, like, captured it. You wouldn't even know. I guess they could have.
No, I didn't know. I mean, I can tell you what they found later, but yeah. I wouldn't know, no, and that was it. But, you know, that was all about maximizing you. That was about maximizing your potential.
Yeah, I mean, if you could, you'd want, like, five teams in there. The same
you'd want to saturate the area. I mean, there's only so many people you can send up to the lake because of logistics, simply because you need canoes and there's only so many on there, and to get to the base camp where I needed to go, that you are restricted in what you can do. Mm-hmm. But there's no reason, for example, why you couldn't have another observational team, say, in farmers' barns where there'd been sightings as well, or doing stakeouts of the farmland on the edge of the jungle. Yeah, you could. But I had 10 people from three or four different nationalities, plus all the local Sumatran guides there. So I'm then managing a maximum time, certainly when we're taking the people up to the lake, up to about 30 people. And also, when you're sending people off, you know, it's not like when you're sending people off on holiday saying, see, you have a nice day. If I'm sending people, say, to canoe on the other side of the lake to go into a bit of untraversed jungle or hardly traversed jungle, then it's a potential risk for them. So I have to weigh all these things up. On the lake, for example, the weather can change. It can be quite dangerous. So there's a lot of permutations. There's only so much you can effectively do. So sure, in the lowlands, you could have more people because I don't think that's particularly risky. But certainly up at the lake, you have to be careful how many people you manage. Things start to change there. It starts to get more extreme.
Right, right. Well, nonetheless, this sounds like a massive international effort alone.
Yeah, and you've got four different nationalities. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely.
Okay, so you're the two teams have split up. I know last time you were there, you guys had a pretty dramatic sighting, and I remember you saying Sahar saw the creature. Do we have any actual eyewitness sightings this time around?
No eyewitness sightings, but we've probably got something that potentially could be more important. We went to the area where Sahar had the sighting last time, and we set up camera traps, but nobody saw it this time. There was a potential hearing of it. A day or so after we got there, but that isn't substantial enough for me to talk about it in any length.
Right, right.
And
even
no sightings.
And even as exciting and sort of titillating a sighting is, you know, it's not necessarily something that really we can bring back from Sumatra. You know what I mean? It's sort of like a fantastic memory for the person, but it's not good enough for, like, anybody who wasn't there. You know, it's like watching someone, hearing about someone's vacation story. You know what I mean? It's like we need something a little more tangible, as awesome as it would be to see it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think Andy reminded me of that, Andy Sanderson, when we were there, because he hadn't been for a few years. And you know, he's conscious of my desire to, I mean, I make no bones about the fact that I know the Orang Pendek exists, so I'm out to prove it. So
right.
that's why it's very important that the objective of scientists who analyze the stuff are objective, yeah, so because everybody knows where I'm coming from. And I'd love to see it on a personal point of view, but would it add anything to the party scientifically? Well, no, of course, absolutely it wouldn't. You're better getting tangibles. And I was firmly of the opinion that, you know, given the choice between another sighting or gathering some tangible DNA, I'd take the DNA any time. Much as I want to see it, I'd sacrifice my own personal sighting for DNA any time.
Right, right, because the better the case is for it, the more funding we can get to go after it, and, you know, the more interest gets generated, you know, like the momentum.
That's
it's the
right.
momentum story again.
That's right, exactly, and that's what you're after.
And so, on that note, what kind of stuff did we... I keep saying we, I don't...
No, it's cool, we've been talking for years, now you're part of the team, Tim, so come on in through the virtual door and join me.
There you go. It's completely subliminal, folks. I don't know why I keep doing it, but I've noticed it. So what kind of tangible stuff did you guys bring back this time around from the trip?
Well, the second team, I'll start with the second team first of all. They found prints, which some of the guides said were Orang Pendek prints, which was marvelous, yeah? Mike and Rebecca Lang, Mike Williams and Rebecca Lang have taken them back to Australia, and that's fantastic. Our team up at the lake, the last time I was there in 2000, we traversed the area where there'd been sightings before and where I'd found, together with Andy, a print in 2001. And we didn't get any joy there. We set up camera traps and left them, etc., but once we traversed the trails. Then we went to the other side of the lake, and it's quite strange actually the way it works, because one side of the lake in terms of the vegetation and the animal activity is very different to the other side. Hmm. And on the other side, it's even remoter, if you like, so very few people bother to go there. And what I basically do when we're out is although we move very, very slowly through the jungle, we don't make a sound because we're hoping to hear it. But we're also obviously scanning for any prints, or anything that we can possibly find. And we scan the game trails as they go along. And also we're looking for places to see camera traps. And we'd found little evidence or some slight evidence on the other side of the lake. For example, we'd seen stem ginger plants snapped, and the Orang Pendek reputed to eat ginger. Mm-hmm. But we'd found very little. And and I was also conscious of the time because we have to get onto the other side of the lake. And I was sort of about to say to Sahar and John, well, let's turn back. And I said to them, well, okay, before we turn back, let's just have one last scan of the trails up here, and then we'll turn back. And they just went slightly ahead. We were in a group, and John comes back and says, look, we think we've got something. So we went over to where they'd been. They'd only gone for a minute. We went over to where they were, and there looked like very, very clearly what looked to be a print, extremely clear. You can see it both on my site on Facebook and on the Extreme Expeditions, Adam Davis on Facebook, and the Extreme Expeditions site on Facebook. You can see the print very, very clearly. It looked extremely like a handprint. We were really excited, and we made a mark of it and then moved on, because you don't just stop at the one print. Yeah.
Right.
So we carried on looking for more trails. And then on a tree, John, who's Sahar's brother, found some extremely strange looking hares. Now, I'm very familiar with hares of creatures in the jungle. I wouldn't call myself an expert, but for example, tiger hares are very white and tapir hares tend to be grey. But these look extremely unusual, and it was in the vicinity of the print, which was extremely exciting. So we had a good scan and we didn't find anything else, but we found those two things. So Andy Sanderson made a cast of the print. And it looked like the Orang Pendek has been turning over logs to look for insects. Now, you remember when I found the print last time in 2001, I said that one of the things that the Orang Pendek seems to do is move through the jungle like treating it almost like a supermarket. So it snacks as it moves through the jungle, yeah?
Right.
And it turned over a log with relative ease, and Andy and I had struggled to pick this log up, you know, two big blokes. So it shows its apparent strength. And So we made a cast of that, and it's a great cast. It's come out beautifully. Love it. The hares, I put a face mask on and gloves. I removed the hares from the tree with tweezers. They were immediately put in ethanol because it's too damp to carry the stuff through and anything else. So they were preserved in ethanol, and then they were then, when I got back, split into three different sections with a control section kept for me, so four sections.
Okay.
The hares went to three of the leading scientists in the world to be analyzed, who are the leading geneticists in their field to be analyzed. Forgive the name, Professor Willislav in Denmark is doing some DNA testing. Todd Disattel from America is doing it. And Professor Brian Sykes from the University of Oxford is not only testing those, but testing the hares from 2009. I kept a control sample of that as well, and he's testing both. Now, Professor Sykes, I went down to Oxford to see him in just before Christmas. There couldn't be anyone more. All of these guys are top-notch scientists.
Yeah.
But there couldn't be anyone more eminent than him. He's a lovely man. He wrote The Seven Daughters of Eve, which is an international bestseller, which basically says that we're all descended from seven particular individual clans in Europe. So, you know, the fact I mean, I'm honoured that these guys are all volunteering to do it, but the fact now is that I've got people of this pedigree prepared to test the evidence, which is A, costing them a lot of their time and their money, and it's costing them a lot, but B, you know, I mean, Brian, I've been in regular touch with him, he's been getting hair samples, he said, oh, I've just been to go and get a Sumatran tiger hair sample, for example, he said that to me a week ago. Shows just how much we've moved the bar in terms of this research, because I can tell you that 10 years ago, if I tried to get this, people wouldn't have been would have been very, very reticent indeed. Not these individuals, I can't speak for how they would have behaved.
Right, the community as a whole.
The community as a whole would have been, reluctant. I remember Hans Brunner telling me how some of the scientists he'd worked with had told him really to be very wary of this particular field. So now these guys volunteering, I think it just shows how seriously, certainly in the nature of the Orang Pendek, people are taking it, yeah? I mean, Brian obviously read my paper on the new primate species as well. And, you know, I don't know what conclusion these guys will come to. They may not be Orang Pendek hairs, Tim. They may be something else, but I know now with 100% confidence that if they are something special and unique, then they will say so, and they will have no qualms about saying it to whoever listens.
Okay,
so
now
that's fantastic.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's you know, this is fantastic that it's getting in. You know, it's moving up the chain of
definitely
of academia. Now, I get two questions, I guess, with regards to that. Is there a timetable on when we'll find out information on the DNA? And then it sounds like, I guess, extrapolate a little more, because I was going to ask, but you sort of you suggested that's the case, that someone, this guy, Dr. Sykes in Oxford, he's trying to take a look at both DNAs to see if they match so we can get, you know, that'll be really good too, obviously. So I presume that's what he's trying to do, right?
Yeah, I haven't put a time limit on it, and I wouldn't want to suggest one. I think, you know, I am what I am in the sense that I'm a field researcher. I gather evidence, but it's very important to me that the evidence is analysed objectively and scientifically. And once I've given those samples to the scientists, then it's my job to step back, I think, and not get involved. I think I leave it to them to give me a timetable and tell me, you know, when they're ready to release things or to say, well, I'm sorry, Adam, it's not what you hoped for. Either way, it's for them to tell me, and then it's for me to talk about it with the team, and then us to plan when we tell the rest of the world. I think I have a responsibility to the scientists, to the team, and then to people who are interested. If we do get mitochondrial DNA off that, I think there'll probably be a lot of people who are interested. But that's not a hint, because I just don't know anything more than I've imparted on you. And yes, in answer to the second part of your question, I'm sure he'll do some comparisons. One thing that I did think, you know, just as we were talking then, I thought was interesting, that encouraged me slightly, you know, I think it's important I say, as I said, you know, the hairs don't necessarily come from the Orang Pendek, but the handprint was in the vicinity, and it's an area where it clearly traverses to look for food.
Mm-hmm.
But when I took the hairs out of the ethanol to separate them into the three respective vials that went off to different parts of the world, as I've already described, they certainly seemed to have a sort of blondishy tint to them. Now, that encouraged me because an eyewitness who I'd spoken to at the foot of the village, of Sahar's village, said that he'd seen an Orang Pendek active in the area only a few months before, and he described its hair as being of a blondy colour. So you never know, you know, it's a roll. But Brian will also be testing the 2009 sample as well, yeah, and he'll go through it very, very fully, Professor Sykes. I have no doubt about it.
Nice. So this is, you know, it's sort of like, I can't find the proper analogy, but it's sort of like, you know, you get the pieces of the spacecraft, but it's, you know, the responsibility of the astronauts to drive the shuttle or whatever. That's a terrible analogy, but it's the best I could come up with.
No, I think it's right. I think, you know, it is about gathering evidence, because, you know, one of the things Professor Sykes said in his book was extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. And when Andy and I first published some results in 2001 about the possible existence of the Orang Pendek, off the record, a scientist who is quite eminent but will remain nameless for this day, said, well, you know, Adam, if it was a new species of frog, you'd have no problem. It would be in nature right now. But because of what you're trying to prove, you have to come up with something really significant. And no photograph in the world will do it. You know, the most conclusive proof I can get, because I'm not going to shoot one ever, would be mitochondrial DNA. Now, if that comes up, then that's kind of sort of my job done. I think that's the high watermark. I'm fully aware of my own limitations as somebody who funds himself, and with the goodwill of those people who are kind enough to come with me on these expeditions. So that's what I'm looking for, and I think that will tip the bar enough for people to finally say, well, you know, the Orang Pendek's got to exist.
Right, right. The unfortunate part, I'm looking at this story here about, have you seen the thing about the snub-nosed monkey they found?
Yeah, Jeremy Holden, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and they just put out, I guess they finally have a picture of it now.
Hmm.
It just was released today, which is exciting. But it's sort of...
I think Jeremy took it. I mean, Jeremy's been involved in the Orang Pendek research. He's a great photographer, and you think he's one of the most underrated cryptozoologists in the world today. So it's remarkable. Yeah, I knew it was coming out, but he asked me to keep it under wraps. He told me a few months ago. So
yeah.
I did know, but obviously it's for me to respect confidences.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, I did know about it, but it is an amazing photograph, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. And I guess the whole thing with the snub-nosed monkey kind of mirrors the Orang Pendek in a way, although they had the whole thing with the body. They found a body of this thing. It comes back to that in a lot of ways. It's like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of, I mean, people, I think, you know, ideally you'd want to find a body. Let's not pretend otherwise, yeah. You'd want to find one lying down in the jungle that you could just get across. But I think the idea of finding something is very... These are very, very rare creatures, really living in quite remote areas, although some of them are coming into human habitat. There's always a chance that some farmer could come across one and in some altercation machete it or something.
Right, that's
a possibility.
As morose as it sounds, that's kind of the ideal... That's kind of what we want, in a way, is just like, you know, an accidental self-defense sort of thing where a hunter in Sumatra gets... We don't want Adam involved in any way with with that, but some sort of serendipitous thing.
You know, Tim, I really don't. I mean...
You don't want that at all.
No, despite the fact in the purest way, I don't want that to happen. I'm hoping with the establishment of DNA and the other proof that we've got, that should be enough to tip the bar, yeah? And then... scientific interest take over. I'd rather that than something die.
Okay.
A horrible death.
All right, that's fair.
If it falls down and dies in front of us, then that's fine. I know that in the purest sense, you'd want a body. But I think if it's going to happen like that, that's the most likely scenario, yeah.
Yeah, some accidental thing.
Yeah, some accidental death. It gets hit by a car or something as it comes out of the village.
Exactly. All right, so we're waiting on the DNA evidence. Any sort of other insights into the trip? What was it like on a personal level to be back in the jungle after all these years? And, you know, is this feeling like, do you feel at home almost there, or was it getting...
I wouldn't say all these years, really, because, I mean, I was in the jungle in India only 6 months before, I think I was in Sumatra a year or so before. It feels very familiar, Tim, after up to six times. I pretty much know it. I know all the routes there, so it's almost... I've spent more time in Sumatra, I think, than any other country in the world other than where I live. So, I mean, on a bonus point, you always lose weight, so I look pretty damn hot when I get back. No, I'm joking. So it's a good time to go on the pool straight after you come back from Sumatra. No, I'm not serious. But you do lose a lot of weight. It's hard slog. It can be quite dangerous. You know, there are things to worry about, but it also can be magnificent. You know, if you're sat at night towards the end of the expedition when you've done all the hard work and you get a little fire going and you're having a few drinks and the stars are up because you're at elevation, it's a remarkable place to be. So it's very beautiful, and I do like it. And you never know... watch this space, because I may go back sooner than I can say right now.
Uh-oh. That's exciting. Now, any you know, perilous moments on the trip where you're a little concerned, or did it go pretty smoothly in that regard?
I think, you know, I talked about the advent of technology. and how things are changing. And I think the only moment where I thought was a bit hairy on the trip was on the last day when we were trying to get people down from the jungle quickly before it got to night, and a storm started. And I sent, the crew went down first of all. They had some flights to catch on with. Then I sent Tim and Richard down because Tim had got an injury and Richard wasn't feeling too clever either. And myself and Andy and Dave were waiting for the last, for the guides to come back. And because it got very, very late, we ended up having to canoe 5K across the lake in rapid time. And I remember getting cramps in my hands as we got down. And then we had to climb traverse a hill at the top. And then as we got down, it was chucking it down. It was getting very dangerous. It was getting dark. We'd not been obviously in seeing any sort of commercial things for a while. So, you know, we shied away from a car headlight when we finally got to the village. We got to the half house and there's a kids TV program on the telly that I recognize. And I was like, oh my God, you know, such a transition from the middle of the jungle to that. But that's modern technology for you. So, but I wouldn't say I felt any particular life risks. I'm always conscious of worrying about it, and I was very relieved to see the other team were in one piece, but not when I was there. Obviously, Sahar passed away shortly after we got back, but not because of the expedition, just because he had an illness.
Hmm. Well, that's probably a good... Is there anything else we should talk about with the trip?
No, I think that's it. I think, you know, right now, wait and see. And I've given you a taste of that. I may go back sooner than you think.
Right, right. Did you pick up any new sort of insights as to something you might try next time?
I think, you know, next time I'd like to spend some more time in the lowlands areas because I think they're picking up more and more results there. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, as human encroachment has come along, what the orangutan deck has done is, by being intelligent, is adapting more and more to the environment that surrounds it. So it's getting bolder in the sense that it's spending more time in, for example, farmers' barns looking for sugarcane. It's getting less shy of people.
Oh, boy.
So that might be a good way forward.
Yeah, that's interesting. Is that something that had come up before in the past, or is this sort of a relatively new development with the legacy of the creature, if you will?
I think there's always been sightings, but in my experience, having gathering sightings, it's becoming more frequent. So I think and you can draw a very slender parallel, say, in the United Kingdom with the adaptation of foxes, and then you saw the urban foxes, they came more and more into the area because they were resourceful creatures. The orangutan deck is obviously on a different scale and it's a rough parallel, but I just want people to see how I think it might behave.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, that could be, you know, it's an unfortunate development in a sense because it sounds like it's kind of threatened, but then in a lot of ways it's a good development that we might get better documentation of this, even if it's picked up by someone taking a picture of it, you know, rifling.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the most likely scenario right now is a local farmer takes a picture of it in his barn on his camera phone.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, so then you're back from Sumatra, and unfortunately, this terrible news that Sahar passed away. I was stunned reading this as I was looking at some year in review stuff, and I was thinking about talking to you in January and how much fun we have on the conversations and remembering the story about Sahar and his sighting of the Orang Pendek. And then I saw the news, just heartbreaking stuff. Talk a little bit about the passing of Sahar.
Yeah, well, obviously Sahar has been my guide on five of my six expeditions to Sumatra. And, you know, I considered him a really good friend. We were always in touch, even when I wasn't there, you know. And there was a period where I didn't go for a couple of years. And I've seen his kids grow up. I talked about Raffles, for example, and he's now 16. I remember when he was, you know, a very tiny little boy.
Yeah.
I know his wife, Lucy, and we've been friends for years, and it came as a massive shock. I mean, he said he had back pain, obviously, when we were just before we went out there, and he'd had a couple of painkillers, but nothing would have given you any clue to how seriously ill he was. Obviously, he wasn't aware of that himself. And then Dali, who's another good friend of mine in Sumatra, sent me an email one day out of the blue, and I also got one off Luke Macon, who's out in Sumatra as well. And it basically, Dali's email, I'd logged in before I go to work because I get a lot of emails from America and obviously the time difference. Mm-hmm. I normally just have a quick look at my emails before I go to work early in the morning. And Dali, one just flashed up from Sumatra saying, you know, Sahara's dead. And I was like, you are joking. What are you talking about? And he said, no, Sahara really is dead and he passed away. And, you know, we just feel absolutely terrible about it. And the CFZ launched an appeal. You can see it on the website to give money to Sahar's family because he leaves behind three children and obviously a wife. And I just felt absolutely gutted, you know, to use an English expression. He's a great loss. I mean, in my opinion, having been all over the world, you know, I've been to the Himalayas, China, Mongolia, Russia, you name it, I've been.
Yeah.
He was pound for pound the best, most instinctive tracker I ever met. He's on a par with the pygmies in the Congo in terms of instinctual nature and tracking ability. There was nobody like him. He was unique and a remarkable man. But I don't, and although I feel very, very upset when I talk about Sahar, I thought about what I was going to say, and I want to leave. Sahar had a great sense of humour, and I want to leave the Sahar topic with a funny story, which is how I want to remember Sahar as a great man and with a great sense of humour. And when we first got to the jungle, Dave won't mind me saying this, but when we first got to the jungle, we had sleeping arrangements and the locals sleep. I used to sleep in this, but now we don't. But the locals sleep in a pond dock, and they all slept together. And there were a couple of tents where Tim, Andy, and I, and Richard, and Dave slept. Now Dave snores like a water buffalo. He won't mind me saying it, but it's not like, it's not a or a, it's a.
Oh boy.
It's so loud, yeah. It's so loud. Like, it feels like the jungle's resonating, yeah. Absolutely resonating. So, we're lying down in the tents, and you can hear this like this, like, and it's like day one, yeah. Mm-hmm. And bear in mind, we've climbed up this volcano, so we're a bit knackered anyway. And I could hear the Sumatrans chattering away. Now, you know, a couple of centuries ago, and then I talked about this with Sahar, so clearly we're joking, that there used to be cannibalism in Sumatra,
yeah.
And people used to be called the long pig, because presumably they tasted like a pig, yeah?
Yeah.
When I went over to Sahar in the morning, because we always did him and I always planned the day's activities, first thing in the morning we talked about the tracking, and obviously they'd heard Dave snoring, and I said to Sahar, shall we eat the long pig, Mr. Dave? Yeah? Like this joke. And he just laughed, yeah, he laughed. Anyway, day two, you hear this. None of us are sleeping, right? And it was really bad. And you could hear the Sumatras chattering. Day three, right? Same thing. Sahar comes over to me knackered, yeah, and all the Sumatras looking knackered. And he goes, Adam. And I said, yes, Sahar. He says, do you really think we should eat the long pig, Mr. Dave? And I was saying, no, Sahar, the BBC are going to come in 3 or 4 days' time. We can't say, where's Dave? Oh, well, I'm sorry, we had to eat him because he was snoring, you know? So that's how I want to remember Sahar. And, of course, he was joking, but that's the sort of guy he was. No matter how hard it was, no matter how tough it was, in any situation, no matter how knackered he was, he had a smile on his face, and he carried on doing the best job he could, and he was a great friend. So that's my story with Sahar, and that's how I want to finish on him.
There you go. Yeah, tremendous loss for the effort to get to the bottom of the Ormond Appendix. Just a tremendous loss. Are you guys going to be okay in future expeditions? I mean, you have, you know, relatively quality guys to take his place, in a sense? I mean, obviously he's irreplaceable in a massive way,
yeah,
but you know what I mean.
What you mean. Yeah, of course, there are other guides out there who I've worked with very well. I mean, Dali's still out there. He obviously speaks English. His son, Raffles, is trained as a tracker, and if I do, I'll go out there. I'll make damn sure I take Raffles. And Donnie and John, Sahar's brother, they're all really good trackers. So, yeah, while Sahar is irreplaceable, there are other good trackers who I, you know, who I could use, yeah.
Excellent, excellent. Maybe Sahar can give the Orang Pendek a little push from the other side and help us out.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure, you know, if I do end up going soon, then I'm sure he'll be watching over it.
I hope you're enjoying this commercial break. You're amazing.
They're amazing? You don't even know who you're talking to, Poppy. You talk to them as if they're actual, if you know, as if you could see them.
Oh, yeah, they're watching us.
Yeah, but you're not watching them.
Well, yeah, I can see them.
No, you're not watching them.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
I hope you're enjoying this commercial break. Don't stop believing. Hold on to that feeling.